The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and you're listening to the Monocle Culture Show. This week, we're hitting London's West End, where a brand new production of the musical Chess has just opened. This story of love, politics, and board game-based brinksmanship was dreamed up by Benny and Bjorn from ABBA, with a libretto by Sir Tim Rice. Safe hands for a sing-along success. Chess opened in the West End in 1986, starring Elaine Page, Murray Head, and Barbara Dixon. It then transferred to Broadway in 1988, and it's now back in London at the Colosseum under the direction of Lawrence Connor in collaboration with the English National Opera. Among the cast on this production, we've got the West End star Michael Ball and X Factor alumnus Alexandra Burke as Russian chess champion Anatoly and his wife Svetlana. I was there for the opening night, as were Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times, and Nancy Durrant, commissioning editor for the Times Arts. They'll both be joining me in the studio if, from square one, they're still watching all 64. Chess revolves around, you guessed it, a chess tournament. Set in the Cold War of the early 1980s, we meet the all-American Freddie Trumper and Soviet Anatoly Sergeyevsky as they compete in the final of the World Chess Federation Championships in Murano. Where else? After a fraudulent board flip and some east-west political argument between Freddie and his assistant Florence, she runs into the arms of his competitor, the champion Anatoly. Anatoly and Florence become lovers while his wife Svetlana is left at home to look after his son Ivan, and the Soviet chess star decides to seek asylum in the West. However, his meddling former assistant Molokov has been scheming, and a year later tries to bribe Florence and Freddie to convince Anatoly to lose his next championship. They refuse. Anatoly wins once again and decides to return to Russia with his wife and son, ending the musical with his separation from Florence. Chess was released originally as a concept album before it became a West End hit and has become a much-loved musical.
Wasn't it good?
Oh, so good.
Wasn't he fine?
Oh, so fine.
Isn't it madness? He can't be mine. But in the end, he needs a little bit more than me.
Matt and Nancy, welcome to the programme. Matt, we'll come to you first.
Thank you.
Can you put this musical into a bit of context
for
us? Because it's back in the West End for a short run,
yeah.
After not an auspicious run back in 1988 in Broadway. Talk us through it.
Well, as you say, it began as a concept album, and what's interesting about the provenance of chess, and this doesn't happen so much anymore, is it dates back to a period which was really a big thing with the British mega musical, where these shows began as albums, particularly under Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. Tim Rice, the librettist of this, but having come to chess, having worked on Jesus Christ Superstar, Joseph, and Evita, in particular, a very celebrated concept album. And so the idea with all of these has been, how do you go from the album to then, in the case of Chess, the stage concert, which I actually saw back in the midst of time at the Barbican, and only then to a stage production. And I think what has bedeviled this show for 30 years and will continue to bedevil it is, how do you actually make it live in three dimensions? The thing that people love about this work, and I love it, is the score. It's very lush. It's very big. It's a sonic boom of a score. But it somehow isn't very richly satisfying in three dimensions. It's not particularly richly written. One of the things they did when it went from London to Broadway was give it a book. They actually hired an American playwright, Richard Nelson, to write a story, because it had never had that before. But that didn't work very well, and the Broadway production closed after 10 weeks. So it's been dogged by the problem of, how do you make it live in three dimensions?
Nancy, does it feel like watching an album with some not amateur, some very professional dramatics, but nonetheless, do you think it stands up in its three dimensions?
No, not really. I mean, to be fair, it looks amazing. It really does. The first half particularly is kind of spectacular. But you do kind of think, after a bit, you realise that what you're getting is tiny bits of exposition, very complex, quite squishy exposition, squeezed in between massive pop songs and sort of operatic stroke musical numbers. So after a bit, it's just not very satisfactory.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of feel like there's nothing to, particularly in the second half, it all sort of slides a bit downhill after a while. And I just, yeah.
There's some good stuff in the second half of it. There's some great music in the second half.
Oh, yeah.
Once we've kind of got over a lot of that exposition, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there is that. And I wonder how that works. Where in musicals, I suppose there's musicals where everything is sung, where almost everything is sung. And there's musicals where there's a lot of talking and acting, and then we kind of cut to a song. But there's a little bit in this, you feel that they're going to walk across the other side of the stage and kind of go, I'm having a glass of water. Why? Because I'm thirsty.
And yeah, exactly.
Just do it. You don't need to sing that bit.
Yeah, I do kind of wonder whether, and Matt would be able to cast more light on this, he's more familiar with the show. I'd never seen it before last night. Has it become more operatic for this venue? Is there more of the singing through stuff?
It's hard to say exactly, but I would think, first of all, if you've got an orchestra numbering, what, more than 60, and you're doing
it... great orchestra.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's never going to sound like this in a theatre because no theatre has these resources.
No.
And you've got a limited run, which means that the cast can actually belt it out without thinking, Jesus, in 6 months I won't have a voice and I'll be having surgery on my nodes.
Such a good point.
But the point is that it's in outline. The show exists in outline. Mm. And what we need to do, and if any of us around the table wants to make ourselves available to Tim Rice, I think we would have a chance, somebody to actually flesh it out. That is the literally million-dollar problem here.
Yeah.
Interestingly, there was just a revival of it in Washington, D.C., which I didn't see, but it took yet another approach to it. So it's constantly being, it's prismatic. They constantly are coming at it in different ways, thinking, well, will this work? Will that work? Maybe, as you say, the thing is just to make it a flat-out opera.
Yeah, but the other thing is, I mean, the story is weak. There's no getting away from that. It is really quite poor. The characterization is almost non-existent. And, I mean, these two main characters, these two men, are... You kind of... There is a point where I kind of thought, why am I supposed to care about these two children? These two kind of men who seem to think that everything ought to revolve around them. But you never see any evidence of why these two women think they're worth spending any time with. I mean, I know genius is attractive, but you never see any of that. You just see them flouncing about. And the other thing that interested me, again, as I said, I'd never seen it before, so I thought, I'll do a bit of reading about it. And I looked up the two previous versions, the US version and the UK version, and from what I can gather, and again, you might remember this, both of them ended with a resolution of the actually quite interesting story of Florence's father. Florence is, as she explains quite hilariously at one point, I'm Hungarian. I was only 5 when you took my father. You know, that kind of one of those brilliant moments squeezed in. And there's a possibility that he might be alive. That resolution has been completely removed from this. So, A, it's one of the best stories in the thing and it's gone. B, it's one of the women's stories and they have been dramatically reduced, and I really wonder whether now is the time to do that. Like, let's make a musical, let's revive a musical about two selfish, self-indulgent, annoying men and strip down the women's stories. Yeah, good timing.
Weirdly, I thought exactly that when I was watching it. Yeah, I did feel like that. It's kind of like, why do we like this? Unless you're the kind of woman that likes a man in a very big jacket.
Yes, there's a lot.
There's a lot of big jackets in this.
Oh, yeah, a lot of men bursting at the seams.
buttons
about to pop.
A lot of compromised roll necks in this production.
There were two. I mean, I basically had two reactions. One was, wow, this is the campus thing I've ever seen. I love it. And the other was, Christ, it could only have been written by a man.
Yeah.
It was just, oh.
What about chess as a conceit? Because this was written, I guess, in the early 80s. Abba had just retired, so Benny and Bjorn were kicking about with loads of songwriting talent at their fingertips. What should we do? It was off the back of Boris Spassky and Bobby Fischer. Yeah. All these big, important things, which were internationally televised, were things of international import, were the sort of intellectual figureheads of the politics of the United States versus the Soviet Union. So this was hugely important. In the 1980s, I guess that meant a lot. What do you think contemporary audiences will feel about that? There weren't a lot of young heads in the audience on press night, and I guess a lot of people had come to it after having seen it in the 80s, like me. Only just, though. Yeah. And I wonder how relevant chess is as a thing. I mean, you can't make it about something else, but I just wonder whether the idea has travelled well, Matt.
I'm not sure that the show is actually very interested in the facts of chess or the pragmatics of chess. Mm. It's really only interested in chess as metaphor. And Nancy was talking rightly about the visuals. And there's this, it was kind of comical after a while. It was almost as if all of the characters had this stalker. There was this person kind of following them around with a camera. And what you then saw on screen was presumably what they think at any given moment is the most important. So when you have the amazing Tim Hauer, who I thought was fantastic, playing this American guy with the rather incredible name of Freddie Trumper. Mm. You couldn't make this up. Mm. Against Michael Ball as a Russian without, thank God, a Russian accent. So when they have their big face-off, I thought, oh, let's have the camera show the chessboard and let's see what they're doing. Because I played chess back in the day. Not at all. I mean, yeah. They could have been playing Parcheesi. And what you're looking at are their, you know, sweaty, beaded faces. Yeah. And I think in a way, chess really only works as a conceit. One of the reasons I think the show, frankly, is never going to succeed as a piece of theater is there's actually nothing fundamentally dramatic in it. It's essentially a kind of statement of people's positions at any particular moment, like their characters on a chessboard. Now I love him. Now I love her. Now I'm defecting. Now I'm going home. Now I'm reunited with my son. But there's no sort of overarching drama to it. There's absolutely zero in her life. Mm. And I think, in a way, that's the problem which they have to address. What is interesting, though, is Realpolitik now, you know, God knows America and Russia seem to be at some kind of impasse at the moment. What might be interesting would be to get a really cool contemporary writer to just go in and chuck it all inside out and do a chess for 2018.
Yeah,
that but I don't
would
know
be
that
really
they want to do that.
Well,
probably not.
I wondered that, and because what about the timing of this? I wonder what the cycles of these things are. When this went to Broadway in 1988, after. I don't know whether it was a successful run in London, but then it went to Broadway and it didn't work out. That was kind of high time for the Cold War. It was just coming to an end, but it was kind of almost at its zenith as well, I suppose. What about now? Is it relevant now, the idea of chess aside, but the US-Soviet kind
Actually,
of thing?
I think it is. Yeah. I think this idea of two nations that have reached an impasse is incredibly fruitful. I think the reason it didn't, I never saw it on Broadway, but I think the reason it didn't succeed on Broadway had less to do with whether the Cold War did or didn't suit the time, and a lot more to do, interestingly, with this phenomenon from which the show springs, which is this idea of the British mega musical, which was a big thing on Broadway, of course, during the 80s. It was a major theatrical export, and Broadway by 1988 had a lot of them, and I think was getting tired of them. Mm. And one thing about this show, which is really true now and was true then, is it's so self-important. It takes itself so seriously. And you can see why shows that came after, like The Producers, which is about as American as a show can be, you thought, oh, thank God, something fun.
Yeah,
this
true.
Show is so serious.
It really is. And the first half, you know, the first half is quite promising, at least the first half of the first half.
Right.
You have a couple of very silly camp numbers. You have quite a lot of knowing nods to kind of the sort of trademark America, all of the commercialism and the Russian sort of stiff upper lipness underneath which there's a sort of boiling rage. And it was actually very funny. I mean, every number, my friend and I turned to each other like, amazing, this is brilliant, this is so fun. And then after a bit, it just, oh God, it just got really serious and dull. And it is a musical. You know, it is allowed to be continuously entertaining, and it should be, particularly with those resources. And I just don't think it just doesn't hold up. It gets a bit
muddy. What about the music itself? Because there is sort of operetta in it, and there is kind of rock music, kind of sort of that era, I suppose. It's quite proggy, isn't it? I suppose because it's a concept album as well. It's kind of a bit like There's something Genesis-y kind of about it. There's something kind of very proggy, which I like. Now, I mentioned to Nancy in the green room before we switched on the microphones, I said, this was basically my favourite album when I was a kid because it was my dad had the LP of it. So it was the first tape I made. And she goes, I think that's the squarest thing I've ever heard, to which I took great pride over. So it kind of stands up maybe as a record. But how comfortable does the operetta and the rock music kind of sit together, Nancy?
Well, I mean, I thought the music was great, actually. I found the performances and the orchestra is fantastic, as I think we've already said. And I really enjoyed the kind of little flavours, early on when Anatoly appears, you hear this kind of slightly Russian, kind of klezmerish kind of thing going on, which is really, it's really lovely. It's very rich, very layered, a bit too much of the kind of self-indulgent electric guitar for my personal liking. That's just my opinion. I think the music is by far the best thing about it. I don't know what you think.
I agree. I mean, you've got, you mentioned proggy. I think that's exactly right. I noticed that Tim Hauer, who I mentioned before, the Canadian performer who plays Freddie, he had been in a production of Rock of Ages, which is this jukebox musical, which is nothing but kind of 80s prog rock, doing Aerosmith and Bon Jovi and that whole group. And that kind of landscape informs this. And it's kind of great to hear a show score where you want to turn the volume all the way to the top and kind of belt it out in the shower. But whether that makes for something satisfying in the theater is another story.
Time flies, doesn't seem a minute since the Tyrolean spa had the chess bars in it. All change, don't you know that when you play at this level, there's no ordinary venue.
Also, interestingly, there's a famous song at the top of the second act called One Night in Bangkok. And until last night, and I've been hearing it for 30 years, I never noticed that it's kind of rap before we talked about rap.
Yeah.
It is.
Hamilton, now it's like,
there's a rap.
We've never seen rap before until Hamilton. Well, guys, here it was.
Yeah,
there is.
And that's kind of fabulous.
And that's quite good. That's good, isn't it? That was a good song. And there's some kind of Gilbert and Sullivan in there, the song The Arbiter and the British Consul and all these bits.
That was great.
Which are a little bit like, kind of, I've got a little list from the Mikado. They're really witty. They're really wonderful. They updated it at the opening night, didn't they, to bring in sort of more contemporary things. So there was all that, as you say, Nancy, there was all that sort of vim and vigour and possibility in some of the writing and updating of the writing.
And intelligence.
Yeah.
There were some numbers, like those that you mentioned, which had real wit and intelligence and kind of a little bit of side eye. And those were the ones that really picked it up. Mm. And it's the other stuff which just becomes a bit, it was sort of, sentimental and slightly meaningless. And actually you just thought, oh no, let's have another one of those, because that really, that really caught my attention and made me want to know more about the person singing that piece.
Well, my dear, how boring, he's defecting, just like all the others, he's expecting us to be impressed with what he's done here, but he has to stop to think about the paperwork his gesture causes. We've an embassy to run here if these people come.
We're going to do our kind of further reading section here. Nancy, you mentioned a production called The Machine, which I was trying to get, when Holly told me about your choices, I was trying to guess what this was.
Well, so it was a few years ago at the Manchester International Festival was the first time that it was shown, and then after that it went to the Armory in New York, and I think the second version was a considerably more tightened version. It had the interval taken out, it was about 100 minutes straight through. Anyway, it has quite a number of similarities with this show in that, first of all, it's a play, not a musical, but it's a play about chess, in theory, which, again, sounds incredibly boring, but in fact isn't. It also has...
She's doing side-eye to us today.
It has a lot of media attention stuff. So it had lots of screens and it had moving cameras. It even had dancing. It shows the gladiatorial nature of chess, all the posturing beforehand, all the squaring up. It had an enormous number of similarities, but it was fundamentally different in that it had a really good story. So the story is based around Garry Kasparov's match against Deep Blue, the IBM computer, and it follows, again, two men, two geniuses, Kasparov and also Feng Xiong-tzu, and I can only apologise to any Taiwanese listeners because I'm not entirely sure I've pronounced that correctly, but he was the man behind Deep Blue. He was as driven as Kasparov, and the stakes were as high, I think, for him as they were for Kasparov. Nobody really knows about him. So it was just a really interesting thing to bring those two characters together. It went backwards and forwards in time. It showed you their backstories. It made you understand where these two men had come from, which I don't think chess does at all, even though there's a, oh, poor me, my parents didn't love me number in the second half of chess.
That's
from
the third
Trumper.
To last scene, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh,
by
the
way,
child.
By the way,
it's the big rock
exactly.
number.
And you know, by that stage, personally, I was a bit, oh, really? It's nobody else's fault again, is that right? So you know, he'd lost my sympathy by that point, unfortunately.
I want to see the indentation that Nancy's notes made in the notebook. She sort of angrily scrawled in the Colosseum.
But The Machine was written by Matt Sharman, who has since gone on to write Bridge of Spies, the Hollywood movie. And it was just a really interesting, rounded portrait of all of the people involved. It had a great role for an older actress. Francesca Annis played Kasparov's mother, Clara. Yes. She was real. She was complex. She was a sort of mother trying to hold on to the son, who was also the boy genius who she moulded and created and then was kind of moving away from her. So it was just a really interesting, brilliant, energetic, exciting production, and I loved it.
Matt said that the staging of the chess bits of chess, which aren't what the thing is necessarily about, but that is the theme. How did The Machine stage those bits of the dull work of the game of chess?
Actually, again, you say the dull work, but what they did was exactly what Matt mentioned that chess doesn't do, which is focus the cameras. And it was in a huge space, so you had these massive screens, a bit like last night. It focused the cameras on the chessboard. So if you didn't know anything about chess, it was meaningless. But somehow they managed to make it feel incredibly tense. And they got it all perfectly timed and every move was correct. It was nerdy to an unbelievable point, but it was absolutely perfect in chess terms, apparently. Again, how the hell would I know? But so I'm told. And actually, you suddenly... Of course, they did the same thing that chess stars and that the media did at the time in both cases, which was ramp it up with the kind of PR carnival around it. And so actually, by the time you were looking at this chessboard, you were thinking, oh my God,
there was Jeopardy.
There's a white one, there's a black one, they might go the other way, oh help. It was really, really thrilling.
What other... Far be it for us to call chess a board game. Can we do Snap, the musical? Drafts, the musical? Cluedo?
Monopoly, the musical?
Yeah.
That would be quite
interesting. It's a little bit more universally themed.
Actually, I think, to be honest, I think there is talk of Monopoly, the musical.
Oh, God, you know, I think you're right.
I think
if you Google it, you'll see that somebody is... Because now, of course, musicals are all about brands.
Yes, it's true. I suppose it's a bit like the Lego movie. But...
Yeah, exactly. That'll be a musical soon on stage.
Yeah, you always...
Should we just write it for anyone else?
Yeah,
it's such a good idea, guys.
This is completely
this
wasted.
This is a world waiting to happen.
It totally is. Come on. Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. To pick up on what Matt was saying about the sort of mediated nature of this production, you said it was very successful in The Machine. Mm. There was a lot of it here. It's a strange thing where it didn't seem to be... There were bits where they were doing interviews, and of course you saw them on the big screen. There were bits where he was selling his American corporate gear, and it was on the big screen. And the chess game itself, you saw their sort of faces. Didn't Tim Howard look like Richard Dawkins as well?
God,
it's strange.
It's
speaking of Richard Dawkins.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Anyway, but you saw the big close-ups of these sort of the brain, you know, the man thinking, you know, of his moves kind of thing. But then it seemed to wind its way into all elements of the thing, almost not necessarily when they're in their hotel bedrooms and things.
Yeah.
But there seems to be moments which shouldn't have been mediated on these huge screens, which made it feel difficult for me to sort of concentrate on the actual singing and the action and the stage work. I was always kind of expecting it to be on a kind of jumbotron, like I was watching the Rolling Stones at Twickenham or something.
Yeah, I did find myself looking at the screens far more than I wanted to be, because you do get a very different emotional response, I think, from watching somebody on a screen, even when they are in front of you, than actually trying to peer at their face. And I felt particularly that this, I may be wrong about this, but I thought it weirdly did a disservice to Alexandra Burke, particularly.
Totally.
Because, A, her role
is... She's an amazing singer.
Woman's got pipes.
Yeah.
I mean, really superb performance, I thought, in terms of her singing. But she was given... she may well not be able to act. I don't know, because she wasn't given any opportunity to do so. So she just stand on one side of the room and belt, and then move slightly to the other side of the stage and belt. And she did that, I think she had three numbers, is that right?
They've given that character a new number,
right,
which hasn't been heard before in the UK.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so just to beef up the part.
Yeah.
So you're that much more aware of her.
Yeah, but what you're not aware of is who she is at all, you know, as a character. And every single thing that she had to do, there was very little of staging in those particular parts. There wasn't much in the way of props. There wasn't much in the way of background. She just stood there and told you how she felt in song. And I felt like I was watching an arena performance by Alexandra Burke surrounded by a musical. You know, it was very... I just felt like she was completely isolated by the video screens, by that process, which was a shame, because I'd quite have liked to see more of her.
That's the one bit that maybe worked. She felt tired and sad and alone in Russia all on her own.
Exactly.
And her husband had left her.
Yeah.
And accidentally, that's how she felt yeah. the whole way through.
Yeah, exactly.
So Nancy's talked us through The Machine, a way that's dealt with the idea of chess, again, as a sort of metaphor and as a gladiatorial concept and all the rest of it. Matt, you wanted to talk us through John le Carré.
Yeah.
And Cold War novels and the Russia House specifically.
Yeah, probably less the Russia House per se, if you don't mind, and more John le Carré in general. The question that we've been posing throughout all this, where's the authorship in this show? Mm. Now, I don't think John le Carré at this late date in his illustrious career needs to or would ever want to write a musical, bless him.
Although, God, wouldn't that be great?
He might, because, you know, his sister, Charlotte Cornwell, is a wonderful actress who doesn't do as much work as she should and as she used to do. However, Tim Rice probably has very good Rolodex, if those exist anymore, and I'm sure he could find John le Carré's number. And I just thought, thinking about and looking back on le Carré's, you know, literary output, everything that chess is lacking is there in his books. You've got doubt. You've got people paralyzed by indecision. You've got East versus West, where even with George Smiley, who, of course, is a British figure, and whereas chess is America, Russia, and the British are mostly figures of fun. But, you know, that kind of nuance and that sense of it's all up for grabs. Exactly what chess doesn't have, because it's painted in the broadest possible brushstrokes, exactly what John le Carré might have lent to it. And I was also thinking, you know, he always used to talk about the Russian bear was an image that occurs in The Russia House, the novel, and then it was made into a movie with Michelle Pfeiffer. Wouldn't she be great in Chess the Musical if she could sing? Well, she does sing a little bit. But I thought watching Michael Ball, he actually looked a little bit like a Russian bear. There is something kind of bear-like about him. They should merchandise him in the foyer as a kind of...
Bear
doll version of Michael Ball that you can take home. And he's got a considerable fan base. You might snap it up. So I think, you know, Matt Charman would be a good choice as a writer.
Oh, yeah.
I'd forgotten that he'd written the Spielberg movie. So, yeah.
The
Machine actually led to something.
Yeah.
I think this is unfinished business, this show. And I'm sure that they're going to keep going for the rest of their days trying to find collaborators.
You're looking for the subtlety and the doubt in le Carré.
Yeah.
And those characters who aren't emblematic of either one or other nation or belief system. They cross the floor and they're kind of independent actors almost.
Absolutely. But of course, the thing is, what you get in a novel, which is very hard to put on stage, is in a novel you can easily dramatize the workings of the intellect. Mm. That's generally dry on stage, unless you're somebody like Tom Stoppard. There's another idea. That's why I suppose in the show you need these characters who are almost comically volatile. Scarcely has Freddie, the Tim Hauer figure, emerged at the beginning before he's strumming around like John McEnroe, different sport, but John McEnroe in a bad day. Mm. And, you know, Anatoly is defecting one minute, not the next. He have this sentimental reunion. Everything is writ super large. What's great about le Carré is the quietude, the sense of an inner life. I'm not asking for chess to become Chekhov, but I do think, you know, the songs are robust enough that there should be a possible linkage that does justice to the whole package.
That brings to the end of today's programme. Thank you both very much.
Sure.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Chess is showing at the Coliseum in London until the 2nd of June. Get your tickets now if you dare. Thanks to my guests today then, Matt Wolfe and Nancy Durrant, and of course my producer, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week when we'll be taking a tour of the new abstract photography exhibition at the Tate Modern. It's called Shape of Light, so join us for that one. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.